My work in the investment realm is an expression of who I'm bringing back when I am at the grammar table. With that, I get to actually express myself in the world of grammar in a way that creates conditions for more poetic moments to some extent, hopefully not just for myself, obviously, but for others, because I'm looking for a tribe and I want to create these opportunities for others. So to me, these are merely extensions and vehicles for expressions that allow, in part, playing using the legacy tools, in part, using the futurist tools and blending them together. I do believe that it takes a little bit. Yeah, I've just kind of learned to get comfortable with taking a little bit of the inertia within the system and trying to rechannelize that and intentionalize it. It's kind of where my gift is in taking what secularized society calls assets, and then more narrow concept like cash flowing assets, and then intentionalizing them to bring out conditions that more of us would want to live under.
You're listening to Catalyst Talks, conversations with change agents, outliers, superheroes, and truly conscious leaders modeling what it is to be an unstoppable force for good and truth in this world. What lit these catalysts on fire to do their work, and what nuggets of wisdom can they share with a world literally on fire? I'm your host, Stephanie Traeger. I'm a transformational catalyst and life coach to maverick change agents in business, leadership, and life. On this podcast, I wear an eclectic mix of hats, including earthkeeper, wayfinder, truth teller, coach, lawyer, business, and impact strategist. My intention is holding space for higher purpose, peak wellness, soul mastery, and deeper impact so we can live in harmony with ourselves, each other, and nature. Please subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen. If you love it, please share and spread the word. We're on YouTube and all the podcast platforms. See the show notes on catalysttalks.com for links, and enjoy this episode. Welcome back to Catalyst Talks podcast. I'm excited to share this conversation with you with my friend Gino Borges, an investor in impact-driven companies with an emphasis on social and ecological resilience. Gino is a partner at Open Path Investments, which transforms ordinary apartment complexes into thriving communities via its Urban Village program. Additionally, he's partnered with Full Cycle, facilitating a co-investment to bring institutional-grade climate investments to retail investors. Gino is the creator of Poetry of Impact. I'd call this a vortex, with a book and a podcast that he hosts. And really, it's a way of being. So let's stop in here with you, Gino. Let's pretend I never met you, okay? And I bump into you and you're emitting your frequency and I say, who are you and what are you doing here?
Oh my gosh, that's a big question. I mean, you start off with such easy stuff to respond to. You know, I guess my life has been felt like a series of chapters, and I feel like I'm always kind of co-creating my existence. I was just thinking about this yesterday. In my 20s, I was very deep into academia. I was trained in one-dimensional finance, reductionist finance for profit, for profit's sake. And that literally put me to sleep at my desk. And so similar to Huckleberry Finn, I mean, I sort of set sail for a journey and it led me to all the way to the Midwest of all things. I was living in California at the time and had a chance to go study philosophy at philosophy of rhetoric of all things at Purdue. And I think that was a great example of just going all the way to the other end of the spectrum in terms of using an entire different side of your brain and just kind of thinking your way through things much differently than the training that I received in, like I say, one-dimensional finance. But I mean, that represented the bulk of my 20s and early 30s. And then 30s were kind of a big wandering decade, honestly. I was the only person that I know of within my PhD class that actually didn't go on to academia. You're essentially trained to go become a professor. And I felt like that was going to be a little sleepy too. So when I turned in my dissertation and they stamped it and approved it, I kind of realized that it was time to go do something, but I didn't know what that was. So of all things, I moved back to my parents' dairy farm, 1 hour east of Reno, which is kind of out in the middle of nowhere in the Great Basin Desert. And I'm in this little ranch house, just really spinning my wheels, super in my head. That was one thing that I realized that was really the, the externalities of a PhD program is that you basically start existing from your chin up as opposed to your chin to your feet, which is where, you know, the bulk of your body is. And I end up writing a book with a friend of mine called Binge Thinking at the time. And a lot of that was just all catharsis. That was just kind of big vomiting, cultural vomiting of just getting it all out. I was really lost. I was super lost at this particular period of time. And one of the things that really I benefited from, you know, whether the universe knew this or not, but I met a woman that I dated for close to 4 years during that time. And she was really experienced in the backcountry. And while I grew up on a dairy farm, I mean, it's much different growing up on a dairy farm than being, you know, out in Black Rock Desert alone in the middle of the dark, you know, hearing things howl and bushes moving, and you just like all your shadows come up at once. And so this other side of the world, this entire spectrum of life force and aliveness started to envelop me and expose me to my spirit side and my life force. It helped me feel alive. And so I did start doing some rites of passage work and started joining a lot of different people in circle out in nature and also in all kinds of, you know, tents and all kinds of fun stuff. It wasn't until my late 30s that I actually ended up seeing that people were actually intentionalizing finance. And so I kind of co-invested at that particular period of time with a few people and realized like, wow, there's something here for me to blend to humanize this experience. And so my 40s has been largely building out that journey and being on that path, starting just really small and really growing with some great people, some great partners, and just a great network that continually trusts me to do the work that I'm in. And, you know, I just turned 50. And obviously that's a big cultural mark of all things. I mean, I know that the butterflies flying around me don't care what day or what, you know, or the dogs that are in the neighborhood care, but it's another potential chapter. So I really feel like my identity, it has always been pretty fluid. And I think that's part of the reason why I have to work for myself, because I have a very difficult time siloing myself, hence where, you know, the grammar of impact comes from and my vocabulary around that, because I kind of felt the torturous aspects of that when like that language gets so finalized around me, it kind of feels like a little bit of a tight vest as opposed to a helping hand. And so it can serve, it can definitely serve. It's just a question of who's serving what. Is the identity serving, you know, my soul, or is the soul serving the identity? So I've always had to navigate that and kind of develop my own rules along the way. And so with that, I don't know where it goes from here, but you know, you asked me who I am and it's really a fluid being that's really focused on aliveness of all things. And hopefully we get a chance to talk a little bit about biohacking and lifestyle hacking, because I feel like I've been doing that for the past 20 years.
Mm-hmm. You and I really jive. I feel like that's kind of where, when I first experienced you, what stood out was this, I was like, oh, he's an authenticity meter. You know, like you will call it out when you see the misalignments and hey, why don't we stand for this? And why are we doing that? And so I really appreciate that about you. And we'll go into all those places, I promise. And one of the things that I want to kind of speak, it's like teasing a lot out of what you just shared. It is this part around grammar. I mean, we need to explain what poetry of impact actually is for listeners who don't know, and like really how you can use it. Though one of the things that I like to speak to you being this authenticity meter, and I am somewhat too, is that I've noticed this really interesting thing lately, and I'm curious if it, I want to hear how this lands for you too, if you're experiencing this.
Sure.
So, you know, there's sometimes you see something and you say something, right? You say, well, why are we doing, like, why are we eating swag when we are all about sustainability, like at a sustainability event, right? Or impact. Why? Like, that's an easy call out. A lot of people aren't seeing it or connecting those dots. But then there's those times where you sort of censor yourself and use discernment, like maybe I shouldn't even say anything, right? And then there's those times where I've seen in myself, and I'm really working in this capacity now to like unhinge this part, but where the program is so deep of not speaking up about certain things that I might see it and not, and it's not, I'm not even aware of it until after. I'm like, oh, well, what's the medicine there for me? You know? So I'm curious if you know what, if that resonates for you.
Yeah, for me, the whole notion of grammar of impact grew out of because grammar is socialized training, in essence, whether it's how we're socialized into the language that we're taught, socialized into the identity, socialized into the tools and metrics that we use. That's the grammar. The poetry is that transcends the grammar. Poetry is what happens when the grammar is serving you. But when you serve the grammar exclusively, what my discovery is that I was always just constantly slumbering through existence. Mm. For me, it's a dialectic between the two. I think when I'm in my 20s, I was in this Rage Against the Machine, Smashing Pumpkins phase where I just wanted to tear everything up, tear all grammar up, and wanted to live exclusively in the world of poetry. And then there's a part of me that realizes that there is a role for materialism as a sentient being in the world. There is a certain amount of innovation that it leads to improve lives and so forth. So these metrics and tools are similar to in the material world, just like a mechanic needs a certain amount of tools or a carpenter needs a certain amount of tools to actually do their work. I think as sentient beings, we also need cultural tools to do our work. And then when we industrialize our goods and services, we have also another languaging of that, which essentially serves as tools. So everybody talks shop talk. Whenever you go to a conference, it's all inside baseball talk and acronyms. And that's cultural tools for that particular silo. After about 2 or 3 days of that, I will start listening to my body, and my body feels like it's been on a lot of sugar, a lot of metaphorical sugar. And there's a part of me that gets high for a little bit. And then I realize wow, I'm going to my room on the third day a lot more than I was on the first day to just chill, or I'm going for walks and ignoring the gathering and just being outside and moving around. And that is because I actually stopped feeling. Mm. I stopped feeling because so much of the process is trying to be resolved in the head by moving constructs around and people whiteboarding, and then people saying, well, I'm going to reduce these 89 categories on the whiteboard to 10 categories and we'll come up with the top 10. And all of these serve a particular purpose until they don't. Mm-hmm. And I guess my body always lets me know, my somatic body always lets me know when they don't. It's just enough. It's guidance and not literality. It's when those moments where you start hearing people all in the room start chit-chatting about trying to finalize those categories or oh no, this should be number 8 and this should be number 6. I was like, you're shitting me, really? I was like, the whole nature of the arbitrary qualities of this, I wish would just get recognized and say, look, this is a collective mosaic of intellectual understandings based on limited vantage points. And we all put it into this stew of understanding. And we're all just going to eat it. Just eat and enjoy. You can tinker with it. But the constant finessing of symbols as if there's some element of finality is the point where I think the impact space goes backwards. I think that's where industrialized consciousness goes backwards. It's like we are incredibly good at the illusion of finalizing arbitrary symbols and facts, and then governing and creating policy around them, and then creating even more influential on a person's day-to-day moral imperatives around them. And for me, that's when the sophist has to come in. Like, sophistry is very necessary during these moments. And, you know, the trickster archetype is really crucial in the poetry of impact, because the trickster essentially goes in there and starts tickling this literality and just just tries to evoke a little bit and see what happens, to see if you have a role in making that fixture just a little bit more fluent. I think that's my gift to the space. It took me a long time to figure that out. It's taken me 40 years to figure that out. I'm still learning where my place is. I think some people resonate with it a lot more than others. I think if you're tired of the space, people get it, or people have been in the space for a long time, they kind of get it. I think if you're new to the space, there is an element of just entering the literality and sucking it all up. And for me, where I'm at this point in time, it's like, what does that evolution of awareness look like that would lead capital to actually restoring capital, being merely economic energy, the storage of economic energy? Some people have, for whatever reason, mostly the ovarian lottery with a fair amount of work, some combination of ovarian lottery and work, some more than others, depending on who it is, have received a disproportionate share of the economic energy of the world. And as that economic energy is being distributed, or the lack of distribution, where's it going? Is that energy going into things that are aligned with awareness and newfound forms of consciousness around connection, mm-hmm. around systems thinking, around intuition? I'm a big believer in intuition. I mean, I know that's hearsay and very pejorative term that gets kind of shitted on by, you know, the scientific community. But I really do believe in my evolutionary inheritance teaching me much more than I've ever learned from in a secularized sense. But it's work to actually do that study, because you have to constantly attune.
Yeah.
You're constantly tuning. And I still forget to attune, even though conceptually I know that. So I feel like a large part of my existence is constantly attuning. And I have various ways to know whether I'm attuned, or if I'm not attuned, how to restore it. And that's a function of being 2/3 through my existence for the most part. You know, it's like just a lot of trial and error and a fair amount of suffering along the way.
Yeah. And that time in the tent, in the darkness, right? When you were inoculated with the switch, you know, there's a lot in there. I mean, there's so many portals of entry in order to help evolve the away from too much grammar, right? To evolve to a more poetic experience as we unfold the allocation and deployment of capital or solutions to problems on our planet. And what I'm finding, because my work is that part, it is working with the people to evolve the consciousness and myself as well, so that we can participate more and listen to our bodies. Because to your mentioned before about biohacking and just really learning, being in your body. I mean, I don't think enough people are actually feeling this thing that I just started to feel. And I've been on this physical wellness journey for 40 years, you know? And it's that I really woke up the other day and was like, oh, my purpose is just to be a soul in a body here now. Like, that's it, you know? And like, what if that's just it? And then what does that mean? What am I doing today in this body?
Yeah. Let me ask you a question, just playing devil's advocate, maybe an angel's advocate more than a devil's advocate. How about this idea? I think I'm inspired by Ralph Waldo Emerson a lot. He's had a huge influence on my existence. But he has this essay called The Oversoul. It's always stuck out to me. Because the Western conception of soul is that it's held within the body. But what happens if it's the exact opposite, that we are incarnated in soul? So actually soul is all around us. And it just happens to be that this material form is moving through soul. As opposed to the body being in possession of soul, but life force itself is soul, and it's mm-hmm. both exterior and interior, which are again, arbitrary boundaries. The flesh is felt, and so therefore there's a sense of realness to it. But this idea, for instance, one of the prayers that I do when I'm sitting in my ice bath each morning mm-hmm. for 5 minutes is that I thank my parents for incarnating my body in soul. And that to me, every time I say that mantra and that prayer, thanks, Mom and Dad, for incarnating my body and soul. I love you guys. Both of them aren't here physically. But every time I say that, I feel this expansiveness mm-hmm. that envelopes my body. And in part because whether it is metaphorical or not, whether it's inside or outside, we perhaps will never know. But the idea of depossessing the body, I think, is part of the freeing process. And that happens through the languaging of delanguaging the assumption that the soul is within the body. Almost, it's really interesting how that the soul's been localized there.
For me personally, I feel more that my, and I feel what you said is the same thing almost as what I it's the words, right? It's so important. I feel that my body, my soul is experiencing this body with how it interacts with nature and the cosmos. Like through this body, I get to have the experience of Stephanie or whatever this thing is, identity, you know, all those things, but it is not in me. The soul isn't in me. It's just using this vehicle to experience nature and the cosmos here. Is that the same idea?
I don't know. I don't know. Perhaps maybe it was just the languaging of it, but I know that in my experience that the constructs I use will be how I end up seeing and feeling the world. Mm-hmm. So when I flip the switch or flip the script on assumptions that are secularized and socialized into us, it's a lot of opening there, and a lot of fluidness and a lot of love, just in the business of kind of, I guess we're in the hobby of, perhaps maybe not in the business of, I'm in the hobby of depossessing things that are just habitually attached to me. For instance, you asked me who I am. Mm-hmm. I can't answer that question because then I'm just going to attach a big fat 100-pound identity weight onto my ankle. And
or
just
you could have answered that.
Yeah.
You
just well, could. I did answer that in a long way. It's my way of saying that if I said who I am within the first sentence, that would have just felt like a really huge ball and chain. And it's been a ball and chain since I got out of high school. Like I think this process already started for me in high school. I just didn't know what to do with it. You know, I tell this story periodically, but my senior year in high school, I was a very poor student in high school, or the high school was a very poor student of me. I could say that, but I will take possession of my failure to perform in high school. So I was not an elite student. I was not perfecting standardized tests. I wasn't being, in fact, it wasn't until about a month before graduation that I realized I learned what AP was. I didn't even know what APs were. But I remember a counselor pulling me aside when I was walking the hallway when I wasn't supposed to be walking the hallway. He pulls me inside and he goes, Gina, you know, you're going to be graduating in about a week or two. You know what you're going to do? I was like, no, not really. And he goes, well, why don't you come inside? I have a little test that will help you, give you some direction. So I went in, took it. And at that time, there was a little bit of a bubble. You had a pencil and you had a bubble in these like little
tests.
It was kind of a Myers-Briggs directional test of some kind. And then what's funny is he had an answer sheet, you know, in scare quotes, an answer sheet that they lay on top and they'd be able to correct the right and wrong answers on this. And he tabulated the score and he goes, oh, you know, it's going to be pretty clear what you're going to be. And here I am, this little 17-year-old kid from a small town in California, grew up on a dairy farm and had never been exposed to too much. And he goes, you're going to be a warehouse supervisor. You're going to be a warehouse supervisor. And he said it with such clarity that I couldn't help but just like, wow, this freaking wow. I was like, life can be that directional. So later that afternoon, I get home and my mom sort of notices that I'm a little distraught on the couch. And she goes, what's wrong, Gina? I was like, the counselor said that I'm going to be a warehouse supervisor. And there's only two warehouses in town. What happens if I don't get a job? And she goes, oh, honey. And she's like, if that's what you want to do, that's great. We'll support you. And we'll love you just as much, but just want to let you know that there's other options out there for you as well. But that's the kind of shit that can go one way or another. Like, I mean, if I didn't have a mother at home who loved me in the way she did, and I was kind of left to just marinate in that literality and that secularized direction, which was just passed down habitually through kind of a corporatized consciousness, that's where I end up there. And yet my being and my presence really wouldn't have been able to be here in full force. And think about that. just orders of magnitude difference between the impact that I've been able to have on life and on myself and others compared to if I was in a warehouse counting bolts. And I'm thinking about the millions and millions, tens of millions of people that are likely have been literalized into their what they are occupied with. And the shortness of service that we receive as a result as humans living together in a village on Earth. And so I'm just always in admiration of those people that are able to crack the code a little bit on that process.
I appreciate this so much. I'm hearing you speak, and what the effect that you have is, you know, this is actually very visceral that I'm wanting to go into some linear path or some literal conversation of a question. And it's just, it's what I'm hearing my voice. Like, it's way more complex than that. You know, like it's, everything is so much more complex than when we really feel it versus like approach it with grammar. And when you're speaking, I'm thinking of the other day on LinkedIn, I saw someone share a video about the metaverse, and it was this kind of short video, and it opens up with, we're going there. And there's no turning back. So this is happening no matter what. I mean, it opens up that way. And I was like, that's how slavery started GMOs, processed food, and, you know, this distorted capitalist society we live in. So discern. But like, I'm sure there are people who, even if their mother did say, Gino, don't worry, there's other options, that something lodged in and formed a belief. And that's how powerful words are.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you look at poetry versus grammar, do you think about it from that perspective as well? As like the kind of the spell, you know, like spelling. We're spelling words. We're spelling when we are using words. So do you see it from that perspective as well? The grammar?
Sure. Well, just think about the authorial nature of you have an adult that must have been in their 40s at that particular period of time telling this teenage kid and saying it with such forceful clarity, as if it was almost like a commandment out of the Book of Commandments. It was like that clear. It's really hard to dislodge that. And there's a certain amount of ethics that I think that are involved and they just aren't taught around language, like language and ethics. And there's a reverb factor to it. You know, one of the things that I enjoy doing is playing the harmonium, and it's a droning device. And what I love is the vibration of it. And it just goes right through my body. Mm-hmm. Language has a vibration too. Both what is said and how it's said have their vibration. Just so like if somebody says something to me really harsh or scares me or yells at me for some reason, not driving the way I'm supposed to and somebody didn't like it. It just goes right through my body and then it seeps into the tissue. And kind of like when a dog gets hit and shakes it off or, you know, a coyote gets hit, most four-legged animals will actually shake immediately off to actually shake the trauma off. Humans don't shake. What they do is they actually just embed that, whether it's a micro or macro trauma within the tissue and just live with it and normalize it and compensate for it, me included. And so when you talk about a spell, yeah, it's a nasty ass spell.
Mm-hmm.
And hence why the literalist should be held to a higher bar than the poets. You know, the poets out there, and when I say poet, I'm just talking about a particular quality of being that somebody engages in. It's not necessarily an identity as a poet or like, I am a poet. I'm just talking about it being, is it one of your faculties that you're bringing to bear on the spell, on how people are spelling life? Because of the structural nature of the spell and because there's such an obsession around while people may not recognize this and may not want to, there is a certain moralizing around when language is used. Like it's directional, like it moves people, it's motive. So language is motive. And it's interesting, like we often associate motivation internally with people, like what's your motivation for doing that? And there's an entire body of thought that says that most motivations are semiotic motivations. Like most people don't even know why in the hell they are doing what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. And if they do try to explain it, what they'll do is that they will lay claim on the very body of structural language that they're, that's providing the motivations. Well, embedded within that language will be the reasons why.
Yeah.
And so it's a circular event. It's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy to some extent. So yeah, it's a spell. I love that idea of the spelling and it having a spell on us.
Yeah. Yeah. So
that's why I would have Haviz as like, you know, it's so funny. We have all these incubation things for impact. We have all these incubators for sort of the technical side of existence to materialize innovation. And we have all this mentorship around it. But the real, I think the real revamping of that whole model would be saying, how do we deliteralize? How do we poeticize these journeys and these paths so that really to get back to the counselor situation that I had when I was 17 years old, that those encounters don't have such a shared literality around them. And where like love trumped the literality in that moment only because it wasn't my own love for myself. It was my love because my mother gave me. But if I was somebody who didn't receive any love, external love, because I didn't know how to self-generate the love at that age, I too would have been motivated by whatever I was hearing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had a test like that as well. I remember also way after, like after I was practicing law, after I had a whole like activism, already like wellness, already coaching, already knew myself and kind of forgot. And then I went to a career coach and this was maybe, I don't know, a while ago, and I remember going through this very literal process also. And then like looking at the results and thinking, like, what am I doing? Like, snap out of it. Where are you? What are you doing? And I think, you know, I'm listening to you speak and seeing the, there's like a haze, like a program, a template over, you know, and I'm in it also a lot of the time and have to snap out of it. And because, you know, it's the matrix, call it what we will, but there's this kind of a program that we operate within and you have to speak the language and it make those bullet points and that's who I am and that's where I fit. And so what does a world look like? Let's have you paint a picture of a world where we are fully embodied. Like you said, you know, what could be the alternative to these incubators for impact or for solutions, you know, driving solutions, when it really is like, how do we embody ourselves? How do we like listen to the tree speak, you know, and imagine that there are so many more dimensions that are just in our tangible linear world. So what does a world like that look like for you?
Well, a couple of things, you know, the idea of a program is programmer or is basically programmer, right? It's like, it's programmer. And that's the thing is like, what's the program? It's like, that's the association. People love programmatic and people, what's the program going to be? And built into that, it's programmer. No one ever says like, what's the pro poetry going to be today? Like, what's the program going to be? You know, I mean, that's just a little bit, but I think we'd all benefit by studying Latin as well in terms of roots, for sure, because that's where the motivation and the structural understanding, it just gets so unreflectively assumed and bought into and used. But in terms of, you know, your vision or in terms of what you asked, you know, you have a lot to share in this as well. I mean, look, you're a woman that threw yourself all into the redwoods and there, chapter of your life was extensively spent in the redwoods, defending yourself and the redwoods, and also acting out of spirit to a large extent, and maybe a certain amount of naivete as a result of just being young.
Yeah.
And it's people like yourself and those stories that I find to be constant inspiration. Mm. And I think that those those stories are possible, particularly stories where people are embedded in the natural world. I honestly think that so much of the secularized notion of problems that we have today are largely because a disengagement with the earthly body, and in turn, a disconnection with our own body.
Mm-hmm.
Because few things can be as informative on what constitutes your own individuation, your own sense of feeling, to the sense of the impressions and the phenomenology of the natural world. So in the world of language, the world of nature is largely a commodity, or is largely to be witnessed. It's largely to be clothed around. Mm-hmm. I mean, ask somebody how often they have taken off their clothes and been with the natural world for any period of time, felt the cold, felt the heat, felt whatever was around them, having the impression, the bugs, the plants.
Mm-hmm.
And the rawness and the vividness and the uncomfortableness and the crazy highs all coming at you at one time, both scared and euphoric, all at the same time, challenging all Victorian notions of what you should and shouldn't be doing. And then coming out of that vacuum of sensuality and coming back into the front country world with that sense of aliveness is like, wow. It's like, wow. And you can't go back. I'm not saying you can't go back to vacuum. What I'm saying is you can't go back to the numbness, because you're realizing like, shit, I don't want to ever go back to not feeling connected.
Yeah. Well, there's something I want to ask you here. So first of all, very recently when I was naked in the mountains, in the rawness of all that, you were my front country. So like I came to your house right after when I came out of the mountains, but full on natural experience being nature, because we are nature. But I've been really fascinated for years and done tons of research, wrote a book, didn't publish it yet, but that I'm fascinated at that moment of what I would call, using grammar, sure there's a better word that I'll feel into, but like the pollution that inoculates. And I'm not to romanticize, or this is really purely from like my perception of, because I've spent a lot of time with indigenous communities. You know, it started in the Redwoods with the native folks who lived in that area. We were always in solidarity in the different areas. I did a lot of activism in the Amazon and spent time in like super, super untouched places, but not uncontacted tribes. But I'm always fascinated to see that, like the folks who had been the indigenous in the Amazon, for example, who had already, you know, took money from the oil company and built their basketball courts, or the ones that didn't, but they lost out, you know, because they wouldn't take, but they still came for the medicine, you know? And so that point where that being so natural, being one with nature, you know, and coming out into this this place of the program, of the, you know, the stuff, and what happens at that moment where we say we can't go back. And I don't want to say they, but there's a large contingent of like indigenous people that once they come in contact with the stuff, they want more stuff. So do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. For me, it's just my starting point. I didn't start off indigenous. I started off with stuff.
Good point.
So I'm on a different path. And if I didn't have something and then got exposed to stuff, yeah, perhaps I would. I don't know what that experience is like. I have a westernized body. I grew up in a middle-class family, so I had stuff. And now I continue to have stuff. I have a kid, so I have more stuff now. And if you have any type of resources, there's an inclination to always add stuff. So, and stuff starts, takes energy, it takes bandwidth, it takes headspace, it takes a lot to service. And yet in the material world, when one's resourceful, the inclination is like this compulsion, as if to feast on the stuff.
Yeah.
It's a constant conversation in my head, because it's kind of a conversation that I'm also having with culture at large, because culture at large is kind of making up the scoreboard, you know, in terms of who's keeping score. But who is keeping score? Is the exterior world keeping score, or is how I'm feeling keeping score? Mm-hmm. And if I stay close to the feeling, but back to your question, I've had stuff. And so I'm trying to de-stuff. And part of that aliveness, like I don't get a lot of aliveness through a lot of stuff. And I'm constantly trying to de-stuff, constantly trying to stop the inclination to add stuff. And the idea was, back to the original question you asked about the vision, I think there needs to be awareness around how you're feeling, not as a construct, but as a somatic feeling about what's going through you. That's the other thing. And I particularly only know that through a connection with the natural world, because it's the mirror for me. I don't know how to do it through another secular being teaching me a construct model and then having a new label of XYZ transformation, XYZ, this, that, and that, and basically just slapping some new lipstick on another body of constructs. I don't know it like that. I've done all that, but every time it comes back to it, I'm like going to be more possessed by spirit by walking with the redwoods, laying on my lawn in the backyard, taking an ice bath, acknowledging the sun when it hits my face, sleeping when I should be sleeping, and just doing all the things, eating when I should be eating.
And what?
Right. So, and with who, right? I don't think this is a singular journey. It's like, yeah, I carry my body around alone, but it's really powerful that when other people are doing very similar things around me, how I see orders of magnitude, my own body get even more engaged, what I already know is best for me. Mm-hmm. And yet if it was just up to me, there'd be a certain level of engagement, but by being in community with others doing that, it's like, it's another whole nother level of engagement.
Give an example of what you mean there, like an example of that.
Well, I mean, I think to some extent, I remember when, like, I went out, for instance, with a group of people in the backcountry, small group, just me and another person versus me alone, and watching that other person knowing how to navigate the backcountry and knowing what to be aware of and what not to be aware of, I would have never been able to go into that uncharted frontier without mirroring and seeing this before me. Like I could get to a certain point, but for me, the earth almost fell off if I went, but she would walk beyond where I thought the earth stopped. I'm like, shit, there's more earth to this place. And you know, it's like, that's really important. Like that's the gift that we have to each other. And we're all on our kind of our own Lewis and Clark missions, metaphorically speaking, mapping out our own territory. But the territory can feel quite small unless we have friends, partners, and equality earthly neighbors who are also walking the path with us and actually doing it together.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, this whole idea of like self-discovery, to me, it's been this overemphasization of self, which like leads to a certain amount of navel gazing that I think is good until it's not. And it's not when it starts to, when there's a lack of awareness around where that boundary or that uncharted frontier is.
Yeah.
And so that's when like you need other people to kind of lead you in, like, I mean, to be the rite of passage guy, like, who are they? Who's going to lead us into the dark? Who's going to help me walk through the dark so I can teach other people how to walk into the dark?
Well, there's the physical dark, and then there is the mental dark or the emotional dark. And for some, you know, being the person who does a lot of the talking and energy work around going into those places, I feel like it is, it's a balance. I think it's, and also receive, you know, of like to your point, so definitely what you just said is like knowing when you need what is, that's the journey because there's a lot of tools.
Yeah.
Okay. One other question I really want to ask you about your work with Open Path. And well, we wanted to also go into biohacking. However, I feel like you're on that topic. So
let's I mean, if it happens, it happens.
Well, no, I want to talk about it. I want to hear what you mean by that question, or even that. What do you mean by biohacking? I don't use that word.
Well, I mean, I think more lifestyle hacking than biohacking. I think the lifestyle hacking is a little bit of what we've already been talking about.
Yeah.
How I think at its core is about aliveness. It's about experiencing aliveness, not from a stimulus, which has a withdrawal, a drawdown, not from something that necessarily has a cost. But I've come to the point realizing, like, I think that there is some actually essential qualities of the universe that when they just pass through you, they're just aliveness, and that they don't fall into the compensatory realm, like getting high off a drug and then having the drawdown on it. Or, you know, having a lot of energy from caffeine, but then having the drawdown, injecting myself with, you know, a lot of music at a concert and then just having a ringing ear at the end and just kind of being fatigued. Like, what are those things that are just going to pass through me that are such an essential part of existence in this universe that when I just touch it, there's a certain amount of glow that just passes through you, a certain amount of light. That's where I think a lot of the lifestyle hacking happens in terms of why I do it. And the other thing is because I don't think I have, I wasn't given a lot of energy in this world. Like, I notice a lot of people have a shitload of energy and I don't know where they're getting it. I don't know if they're internally sourcing it or what, or they're external sourcing and just running their RPM gauge to, you know, redlining it. I don't know, but I know that whether that is a physiological reason because I have glucose issues or whatever it is, I don't know. But I know in the afternoon, and maybe Portuguese and Italian to be stereotypical, but in the afternoon after lunch, I kind of get tired and I just want to kind of lay down. You know, I mean, our waspy Protestant culture just can't believe that somebody would want to lay down in the afternoon unless you're from a farm. And, you know, it's like only farmers can lay down. Yeah. And, or just like, I'm totally like out of a job and I'm without a home. Like, that's who else lays down in the middle of the afternoon to take a nap. I mean, that's like the cultural cliche. But this whole lifestyle hacking, in fact, I was just speaking to somebody yesterday from Nexus about this. And I realized that I always have to tease out the temporal and spatial rhythms of whatever culture is prescribing. Culture has a certain rhythm and drumbeat. Similar to like whenever you do any type of dance, and whenever the beat starts and bodies start moving, it's not like you like press the programs like, oh, okay, I'm going to dance. It's almost as if there's a giant sucking sound and a big vacuum that just pulls you in. It's almost impossible not to move your hips. Even the stiffest person on earth, if African drum circle starts happening, you're going to start moving and just start at least swaying, and you can be the stiffest soul on earth and still move. Well, there's a certain culture has a certain drum circle to it as well. And people and certain players within that culture are incentivized to keep that beat going. And that beat can serve to a certain extent and not serve otherwise. And the only way I know how to do the lifestyle hacking to me is an example of stepping outside of that cultural drum circle. Because, because as soon as I step in, it's go. It's like, here we go. And I have that. I mean, there is a part of my professional side on the investment side and capital raises and trying to close deals. That's all cultural drumbeat. And that's a cultural drumbeat. There's a part of me that just loves throwing myself in there and bouncing around that. But can I do that for my entire adult life? No. I know that when I bounce into that cultural drum circle, that I'm materializing something for the material realm.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point, I have to dematerialize that encounter and jump back out. And I mean, I feel like that's part of the dance.
You know what I'm seeing the yin yang sign, the poetry of impact, yin yang, right? Like, that's exactly, you just explained it. Yeah, an example. That's beautiful. And that's why we work for ourselves. And that's why.
Yeah, that's true.
And I have to say though, I have to say though, I don't do three meals. I don't do breakfast, lunch, and dinner. That's also a construct, you know? Yes. It's and I think that has to do with your own biorhythm, right? It's like knowing your biorhythm. And
yes.
Yeah, that is being in that is the part of being in the body. How do you master this vessel and provide it with the life-giving tools and the life-giving feelings and experiences and flow it needs to give more life, to recharge, to put out and to put in. So yeah, I'm obsessed and have been for decades with this. So we can go down a rabbit hole. another sound word power thing. I don't know what that is, but
those poor rabbits. It's such a negative feature that they have, I guess, to just go down their holes.
I know the words, like the things, you know, like the kill two birds with one stone. Like,
yeah.
So coming back online, just tell me a little bit about how this shows up for you with your work with, creating these beautiful living spaces in urban environments.
Yeah. I mean, I think to some extent, what it does is that my work in the investment realm is an expression of who I'm bringing back when I am at the grammar table. Mm-hmm. And with that, I get to actually express myself in the world of grammar in a way that creates conditions for more poetic moments to some extent, hopefully not just for myself, obviously, but for others, because I'm looking for a tribe and I want to create these opportunities for others. So to me, these are merely extensions and vehicles for expressions that allow, in part, using the legacy tools, in part, using the futurist tools and blending them together. I do believe that it takes a little bit. Yeah, I've just kind of learned to get comfortable with taking a little bit of the inertia within the system and trying to rechannelize that and intentionalize it. It's kind of where my gift is in taking what secularized society calls assets, and then more narrow concept like cash flowing assets, and then intentionalizing them to bring out conditions that more of us would want to live under.
I love that. And I just want to call to listeners' attention how, you know, some people might be listening and be like, what is he talking about? But if you really listen, you are being so intentional about the words that you are using that someone else might say something like the exact same idea in a very secularized way. So thank you for modeling your poetry of impact. And if anything, what other transmission or gift or nugget would you like to share? If you know, someone, people are out there right now and they're hungry for something, they need some wisdom to drop in. What would you share?
I think, you know, the big blessing that happened for me, it was that I started to surround myself with people who were trying to live attuned, and then specifically attuned with the natural world, and as a consequence of that, with their bodies.
Mm.
And I have that tribe around me, and that tribe has made all the difference. It's been the counterweight for any type of cultural weight. So whatever cultural has on one side of the teeter-totter, the counterweight of this tribal experience with the group of people with these qualities is constantly outweighing that. And so it becomes easier for me to be mellifluous with the flow of life than I previously had in my 20s, where I would kind of just keep running into the wall, keep hitting my head, and as a result, did manifest in some pretty intense migraines. Both, even though I was figuratively hitting the wall, it was materializing in the body, in part because the body is keeping score. And mm-hmm. If I didn't have a healthy avenue for getting it out, which I didn't, it would just store up into this big inflammatory moment. And there was a lot of suffering there. And of course, I know that suffering is quite the motive, because myself, when I suffer, I seek pretty quickly, you know, it's like, it's a Homer's Odyssey pretty quickly for me at this point to go seek. It's a Huckleberry Finn moment where you kind of go up the Mississippi on a little raft and go and find your way Yeah, to suffer is an interesting concept. I mean, obviously, there's enormous amount written on suffering, but the suffering in the body and suffering mentally, I'd say that there's a fair amount of struggle mentally as well. Particularly, there was struggles with aloneness. I felt like I was good socially, but I didn't feel like I was really in connection. And that took me a while. And that includes even with my, my parents as kind of later in life, how I learned to connect with them. In part, I think it was all an outgrowth of a fair amount of suffering in my 20s and to decognize the world. So again, I'm very aware that, I mean, my experience is unique to me. I have seen other people have similar experiences when they have touched or been in proximity to people of these qualities that I share. So I'm pretty confident that, I mean, they too would receive some kind of alternative experience that they probably haven't had. And then from there, whatever's moving through you just is constantly an expression of yourself, regardless of what you're doing. We just happen to come in contact with each other because we're both in the world of investing and people that are trying to invest consciously. And we're at the intersection of a lot of cool trends, in essence, and taking legacy features and trying to modify them or actually decouple them. And yeah, it's just, you know, and that obviously is a constant back and forth of conversation of pros and cons around that. And I get that. I think embodiment, like I said, I just turned 50. And on the way out here on this, you know, whatever chapter it is, we spoke of de-stuffing. I'm really moved by this idea of like really being able to constantly let go. So that when like the time comes that like everything that's needed to be let go has gone. And because I don't think death can be too pleasant if like you got your fingernails clenched in, trying to scratch and holding onto the bed on the way out.
Well, why isn't it the way in?
It could be. Could be. Yeah. I mean, we actually come out of darkness into light for a short period of time and then we go back into darkness. So it's really kind of a freak attribute that we're even here, one. And then two, because most of life is in the dark. And yeah, we just have this little brief moment in time where we do get to kind of peek around and see what's cooking, right?
Yeah. And I, you know, I experienced a very similar journey. I think we've experienced a similar journey. And so much of what you're saying around like finding tribe and just finding that where you connect, it starts with connecting with yourself. Whatever allows you to connect more with yourself, do more of that.
Yeah, I would say yourself in relation, though, because I think it's interesting to connect to the self in relation.
In relation.
And I think that that's what's missing.
In relation to what?
Well, because you, to yourself is more about the individuation as opposed to. Because the essence and the meaning for me has come in the liminal space between two lives, not necessarily my own individuation. It's like, I don't know who I am unless I'm in relation.
What if it's relation to spirit or, you know, God or
it higher could be power? Anything. But what I'm getting at is that you said for yourself. And to get back to my point, I think there's been an overemphasis on self because what it does is that it kind of creates this silo around one's existence as this, I think it's this over individualization concept. And I have found that my life improves tremendously when I just constantly in relation to things.
I would love to, I want to honor your time. I would love to have you back, Gino. And we just talk about connecting with other or in relation and with self. This is a deep schmooze on for a while.
And you know, the whole idea of like starting with the dark and, you know, at some point going back into the dark, I think it was the Christian mystic, Meister Eckhart that said something pretty profound. This idea that, yeah, it's really interesting to know what is here. All of our attention is to try to understand the mechanics of what's here. But the real crazy ass feature about being here on Earth is that we're here at all.
I know.
I mean, just think about that.
I'm saying that was what I was verbalizing as being in this thing here, you know, whether it's my soul or what, but that's, yeah, And then we've made this whole, we're just here. And then we've made this whole thing that is more important than that. Like, what's more important than that? All right. Let's leave everyone to chew on that. Okay. Yeah. That we're just here. Thank you so much for your time and energy. And it's great to be here with you, Gino. I appreciate you.
Nice work. Thanks for the invite, Stephanie.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Catalyst Talks. Stay tuned for what's up next, and please subscribe to our podcast and rate us wherever you listen. You'll find these all at catalysttalks.com. Join the conversation on social media, and if you'd like to reach out, please send me, Stephanie, a private message through stephanietraeger.com. Your attention means the world to me. Thank you, thank you, thank you.